Welcome, dear listeners, again to Food Conversations Season 5. Of course, we'll start, as usual, with a land acknowledgement. We once again acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkrepmik people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility for us all. Today, we are delighted to have in the studio two persons who are both very knowledgeable and very experienced in the science and art of growing food and flowers, and then bringing them to market. Pim and Marianne van Overen have nearly a half century of hands-on activity in horticulture and farming, as well as a range of associated skills and specific expertise around the growing of plants of all sorts, plants for both beautification and for eating. After nearly two decades working their native country of Holland, they crossed the Atlantic in 1994 to Canada. They have worked for the last 28 years in several locations in Canada's two western provinces, finally ending up in Salmon Arm in 2014 and becoming owner-operators of the farm they came to call Tasty Acres. They now grow there a variety of food plants and flowers for their own use and for sale in the community. A warm welcome, Marianne and Pim, to Food Conversations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Delighted to have you here. Now let's start with the name Tasty Acres. You didn't intend for people to eat the soil. You chose the name for a specific reason. What was that all about?
I think a name has to reflect a little bit of what you're doing, what you're growing, it has to have a certain sound, and so people pick it up and they remember.
A good Dutch practical name, that sounds to me. So what drew you, let's start off with being here in Salmon Arm. What drew you to Salmon Arm? Now, I know your daughter was here, but there must have been a little more to it than that.
Well, we were in the Lower Mainland for 8 years and then in Alberta for 12. And the Lower Mainland was way too rainy to our taste. Alberta was too cold. So you chose
the ideal situation.
Yes, I think so.
It's not too cold, it's not too warm, it's not too rainy.
Yeah.
Well, that's not a bad choice. A lot of people, one of my very first patients said his father looked all over the province and found Salmon Arm to be the most beautiful, perfect place that he could possibly live. So I guess there's something about it here. Now, there was a property available when you arrived in 2014. You saw an ad. What was it that appealed to you, Pim? When you saw that ad, what appealed to you about the property? What made it important for you?
It probably was. It had 5 acres of soil.
Yes.
And we looked on Google, so it was mostly usable. So
Google, a very useful source of information.
Yeah. So yeah, I thought, well, maybe it is something. Let's have a look. So,
and the driveway was not steep, which is helping as well.
So you were anticipating the winter.
Yes,
situation.
We rented a house before we bought this, and it had a very steep driveway. And in wintertime, it's not so very smart.
No, it can be a huge challenge. There's a few driveways around here in Salmon Arm where people, they don't go up their driveways in winter at all. Now, it was originally sort of a U-pick farm, but you transformed it into something different. You transformed it into a U-pick farm being a nursery. So how did that process go? That must have taken a certain amount of work in rejigging the property and the way it was set up. Pim?
Yeah, I did. When we came there, it was mostly grass. And there were old cherry trees and old fruit trees, and we turned the soil and started planting, and from there it evolved into nursery and later on in U-pick farm.
What did you leave the cherry trees?
Yeah, most of them. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And they still produce a few cherries.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, yeah.
They're not the focus. They're not getting as much attention as they used to.
No. Well, the last couple of years, the cherries didn't do that well.
Mm.
It was too cold when they flowered.
The other thing, that property was already certified organic.
Yeah.
Did that affect you, Marianne? Was that an important thing for you?
Yeah, it appealed to us, but I looked at it and I said to Pim, I'm not weeding my whole life against better knowledge, so we'll try it for a year and see how it works. And after that year, we were able to manage it and kept it that way. And I'm glad we did, but at first it was a daunting task.
What was daunting about it?
Weed control.
Okay. You mean hardy native perennials.
Yes, yep. Exactly.
That's my chosen phrase for weeds most of the time. Yeah, so, but converting it to a different kind of growing, was that an issue as well?
No, not really. We had enough equipment and, you know, what to do. And the first summer was real dry, so it was easy to get rid of the weeds.
Yeah.
So it worked out pretty good.
Well, you mentioned something just now that you'd had a fair amount of experience before this, and I think we need to let listeners know how much experience you had, because you've been doing this for a long time. So, Pim, you come from a farming family. What kind of farming were you doing, and what was it that affected your farming family back in the 70s?
My whole family was in farming, and it was mostly crop farming. So grain and potatoes and alfalfa, grass seeds, flax.
And how many acres did you guys have?
My dad farmed 75 hectares, so that's 150, say 200 acres or something.
That's half the country practically in Holland.
Yeah, in there, yeah, it is. Yeah, it was a good sized farm. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
indeed.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And your family was in the retail work,
yes.
But quite a different field. What was that?
Yeah, we had and we still have a hardware store in my family.
And a big one?
A big one, yeah.
How big?
I can't really compare.
Well, we have a little hardware store called Home Hardware, and then there's a big one down in Vernon called Home Depot.
Anywhere between.
Really? So it was a serious venture.
It was, yeah.
Did you ever work in the store?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I did. When my parents were on holiday, I would take care of the store. It was smaller than at that time, but I would take care of the store.
So it's doing well still?
Yes, it does. Mm-hmm.
Is it still a family store?
It is, and the third generation is going to take it over in April.
Wonderful. Yeah. Well, you'll know where to buy your pliers when you go back to Holland. But each of you went through something that is not so common in this part of the world, and that is quite in-depth training to learn a career. Pim, yours was in farming and growing and then landscaping. What kind of training program is that? I mean, how detailed is it?
It was really detailed. It was what's called a trade program. Mm. So you learn with your hands. And like in school too, we had 2 afternoons a week that we had to go to farm and work there. So 1 afternoon for veggies and 1 for fruit. And that's what I did for the first 4 years, then 2 years an extension. And then I did 3 years of landscaping.
And the 2 years of extension, was that going out on farms to...
Yeah. And in between those 2 years, you had to work the whole summertime on a farm somewhere.
So you learned, but you didn't just learn how to grow food. You learned other aspects of farming, the whole range of skills you need to run a farm.
Yeah, that was part of it too, like welding and mechanics and woodworking and cement and rope and leather and whatever they could come up with, what you might need in your life, so...
But later on, though, you would probably have found that some of these skills at the time seemed a bit, central.
Yeah.
They would have been quite useful.
Yeah, they are. It's still amazing when you walk into an old farm somewhere in Holland and you see tools hanging somewhere that are the same tools that I got when we entered school. You got a whole set of tools and that were you had to stamp in a number and that were yours.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
And you get to keep them at the end.
Yeah, you get to keep them at the end. So.
And which of course, makes Canadians think, well, that would have cost a lot of money. But in fact, your educational process was paid for by...
By the government, yeah. It was completely free, yeah.
something that I think it's worth focusing a little bit of attention on, because in this part of the world, one of the problems is that in order to get education like you did, you typically have to pay thousands and thousands of dollars. Even if you go to the publicly funded schools, mm-hmm. you still have to pay quite a bit of money. I think a lot of listeners are probably thinking it's time we started to subsidize paying the schooling yeah. that people get.
But hey, this was 50 years ago almost, so...
Do you think it's still the same now?
No.
Really?
No,
so in Holland
it changed
you have
a little
pay.
Bit too. Don't you think so?
I think... education is costing quite a bit more.
Really?
Now. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, so everybody's fallen by the wayside.
I guess so.
Not just Canadians. I'm going to just remind listeners that I'm talking to Marianne and Pim van Overen, who are the owners and farmers on Tasty Acres on 30th Street Northeast. So if you want to go there, that's how you find it. Marianne, your beginning educational process was in a different direction. You studied fine arts, but not just fine arts, it's the teaching of fine arts, which
yes.
is quite a specialized, it's not just learning how to paint and do sculpting, you're actually learning how to impart that knowledge to others.
Yes. Yes.
What was that like, and why did you go there?
Well, I was good at drawing, and I didn't want to have an office job. So that's why I took that course, and I enjoyed it. And I really enjoyed teaching, like still do. Like I don't teach anymore, but I've done a lot of teaching, like from kindergarten to adult education.
So you don't
life.
Do formal teaching, but you find yourself doing informal teaching when customers come to the farm.
I guess.
She says modestly. How much was teaching and how much was actual developing your skills in painting and sculpting and whatever?
The hands-on part was a big part of it. Yeah, more so than the teaching part. But, you know, I really liked those classes to learn how to teach and to approach people.
Right. Do you still do any of your fine arts work these days?
Yeah, I do.
What do you do?
I make... I ventured away from paint and charcoal, and I work with fabrics now. I make wall hangings, I design them, and I make them over the winter time when I have time.
See, I asked that question having looked at some of your wall hangings. They're really quite exquisite, very detailed and lovely colors and that kind of thing. So these training programs that each of you did were not just a little overnight venture. They lasted for years. For you, Pim, it was 8 or 9 years, and yeah. for you, Marianne, when you added in horticulture, it was a total of nearly 10 years. That's a long time to be training. Did you, each of you, feel that gave you it gave you confidence to go into some field knowing that you knew what to do? Marianne.
In a certain way, too, but, you know, if you look for a job, you're still insecure at first.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah. But, you know, eventually you understand that you have the qualities to pass on.
How long did it take for you to feel, I know what I'm doing?
Oh.
5 minutes?
No, longer than that.
Well, it just sounds like you did really have some pretty good grounding
yes.
in what you're doing. Pim, what was it like for you when you started working and realized that you're on your own now?
Well, it was a different time because there was always work enough, whatever you did. Mm-hmm. They were just waiting till you came out of school and, hey, come here.
Come here immediately.
Yeah. So that was not a problem. But I started my own business right away. I was just 20, I think, when I started.
Yeah. In 1994, you took the big plunge. You crossed the Atlantic. Your children, I believe, 14 and 10. And so they traveled okay. You know, they weren't really young, and they weren't off on their own traveling on their own. And they adapted well to the new environment, and you moved to the Lower Mainland.
Yes, correct.
Near Mission. And Pim, you were doing landscaping, and Marianne, you were teaching fine arts. How was that coming to this side of the Atlantic and seeing what Canada's like?
Well, in floral design, it's quite a difference. In Canada, the choice of flowers is not as big as it is in Holland. You can get them, but it's quite expensive here. So it was not as exciting, I would say, as I had the experience in Holland.
So where did the flowers come from in Holland? Not all from Holland itself.
No. They come from Israel and also from south, I think.
North Africa.
Yeah, Kenya.
Around the Mediterranean.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And so what did you do? You'd have clients, you'd have people would come and say...
No, I taught at the University of the Fraser Valley, like adult education. That was mostly night courses. Mm-hmm. And then I did weddings on the side. Not a lot, but, you know, a couple of times a year at least.
And how would you be teaching people? What would a typical class be like that you were teaching?
It would be like 20 people of average, and we would have sessions of 8 weeks, and we would start with simple things and then move on to more complicated works. Like we would start with table arrangements, but eventually we would make wedding bouquets in class.
And when you were teaching fine arts, did you have students doing a lot of hands-on work in your classes?
Yes.
They would do painting and sculpting and drawing and sketching.
Yeah.
And you would sort of supervise them and go around from one easel to another saying, no, that won't work.
Yeah.
Do it this way.
Yeah. But my passion is way more with flowers than with the painting and the drawing.
You've evolved into growing growing art that grows.
Yeah.
And Pim, you were farming and then landscaping. Landscaping became a big feature in your days.
Yeah, I did. Mostly because of the money. Because when you landscape, you have your money right away. But when you grow something, you have to wait a couple of years. So,
yes, indeed. So you did some in Holland. What kind of people would be your clients, your customers?
We were close to the seaside, and there were a lot of holiday homes.
Ah, yes.
So that's, yeah. And real big ones. So
big homes.
Yeah.
So these are people who would definitely be able to pay you.
Oh yeah, that was not a problem. So I was there for 20 years. So I have seen little kids growing up, and it was fun.
Would you have clients who would come back to you multiple times over the years?
Yeah,
a lot of it.
Yeah, yeah. Most of them. Yeah, yeah.
Now you said I can't remember which one of you said to me, but being by the sea and knowing that the sea is a lot higher up in the air than the country. Uh-huh. Did that have an influence on the way you decided to settle down as years went by?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Do people in Holland have this sort of existential fear in the back of their minds that one day there could be a big storm or the sea level could rise another foot or two and that would be a real big challenge for the country?
I think the people that remember the big flood in 1953 definitely have that memory and know that the sea is not easy always.
Yeah.
No.
The younger generation is more aware, I think, of climate change. Although we are gone that long, we go back quite often, but, you know, you don't have the same feel as when you live in a country for how it evolves.
Yeah, because, you know, if something happens, it's going to affect you very directly.
Yes.
You'll be in big trouble. Mm-hmm. Pim, what did you think about... Did you have an occasional nightmare thinking of water coming flowing in?
No, not really. But yeah, it's coming because we were close to the seaside and they built a lot of big dams and dams with doors in it.
Yes.
And they made the last one was the biggest one. And when they built it, they said it will be probably used once in 3 years. that they close the doors.
Yeah.
And now it's already 3 or 4 times a year that they close the doors. Yeah. So it's happening.
So do you think in the back of your minds there was some thought, you know, one day Holland is going to be, it's going to be the Netherlands is going to be below.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I've talked to other people from Holland. You had a lot of friends from Holland. They're happy to go someplace where there's a mountain. You can go up the side of the mountain, and yeah. It doesn't matter what happens down the valley. So you moved to the Fraser Valley near Mission.
Mm-hmm.
And what was that like, Marianne?
It was hard.
Did you get work right away?
Yeah. Yeah.
But the locale for you?
Well, I found it hard, even though Canada is supposed to be the same kind of country, the same kind of culture as Holland, like
You felt a little bit isolated?
Yeah, yeah. And especially because I was busy in Holland. I had my own store, and all of a sudden I was taking care of the kids more because they didn't speak English. Mm. So I was the main caregiver. Pim was working. And yeah, I felt isolated at first. It took me a while to settle in. And people in the Lower Mainland are more distant than people here and people in Alberta. So I really enjoyed living in Alberta. We had a nice group of friends. And I really enjoy living here because people are coming from different places, mostly our age, to retire. And they're looking for a new group of friends. And it's easy to get into that melee.
Small towns tend to be like that. They're much easier to get to know people. Mm-hmm. You know, you meet them in the store. Pim, you were working. Yep. You were landscaping. What was it like for you? More rain. You have to work in the mud sometimes.
Yeah, we had one spring. We were cutting lawns once a week. We did it for 3 weeks wet, just soaking wet.
Really?
They told me, "You stupid Dutchman, and you cut in the rain." I said, "Well, you will cut after 3 weeks. I will cut my laugh."
So, what kind of work were you doing in the Lower Mainland, the Fraser Valley?
It was all landscape maintenance complexes with houses, with a wall around it,
and
commercial businesses.
And was it the same as it had been in Holland that you, as soon as you put your shingle up, people started to come to you and wanted you to work?
Yeah, it was not a problem to get work.
Yeah,
I just went around those complexes. And they had all you had to ring the bell to open the door. So I was looking for a Dutch name. I rang the bell, and then they started talking, and that's how I got to know who was in charge of it. And that that's how I worked my way.
You infiltrated.
Yeah,
you infiltrated. Very good. Now you worked there for a number of years, and then decided that's enough. We're going to move. What made you go to Alberta? Near Didsbury, I believe, is where you set up. Mm-hmm. What made Didsbury a suitable target for Van Overen family?
Well, our daughter was going to Olds, which is 6 clicks from Didsbury. She was going to Olds College, and when she did her interview there, I went over to the HR department and asked if they needed an instructor in floral design. At that time, they didn't need anybody, but later on in the summer, I saw an ad posted for an instructor in floral design.
You'd planted a seed and it was growing.
Yes, I left my resume and I applied and I got a job. So
it was that easy.
It was that easy, actually.
I'd remind listeners that I'm talking today with Pim and Marianne Van Overen, who are the owner-operators. No, operators is not the right word for a farm. Owner. Workers. On Tasty Acres on 30th Street here in Salmon Arm. So Pim came along?
Yeah, he
for
had,
the ride?
I moved in July, and then Pim came in December. He had to finish the contracts.
Right.
And he had to sell our property. So,
what was it like going from the wet lower mainland to the dry, hot, and or cold Alberta climate?
No, I really liked it. It was it rained a lot, but in Holland you always had rain and wind. But there was no wind in the lower mainland, so that helped.
There's wind in Alberta. Yeah. There's lots of wind in Alberta.
Yeah, and there's lots of wind in Alberta. No, it was fun to see it, and nice sunny weather a lot of days in the year, in the winter too.
Yeah, the sun in the prairies is something that people talk about. They miss it when they come to British Columbia.
Yeah, yeah.
So what kind of work were you doing there? What kind of properties? Or actually, you branched back into retail. You had a little bit different operation.
We had 27 acres, and I started the tree nursery. And then we had a garden center. We did yew pick and Saskatoon berries and raspberries and in veggies. And you had a tea house, a restaurant, and a gift store. We did weddings.
You did everything.
Yeah, whatever.
You had a multi-factor business, yeah. Who did the tea house?
Me.
Okay.
She was the boss inside and I'm outside, so yeah. I had way more space.
So you could, yes. If you had something else to do, you could say, I'm frustrated. I'm going out or I'm staying. I'm going back in.
Yeah.
What was the tea house like?
It was a tea house. It had seating for 45 or something. And then we had a patio outside. We were open from 10 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon. And it was kind of a destination for people because it was in the middle of nowhere. And we got buses from Calgary with seniors and well, local people, of course, too. Mm-hmm. It was fun.
So that meant you must have done some marketing. You must have told people that you were there somehow.
Yeah, we were on the radio with an ad.
Did you?
Yes.
On radio?
Yeah.
Well, what a funny thing that we're on radio right now.
Which I forced myself because I know I have an accent, so that was recognizable.
I don't think it bothered anybody, did it?
No, but...
Probably made it seem a little more exotic. And you were doing the outside stuff.
Yeah.
What kind of stuff was that? I mean, you had the nursery.
Mm-hmm.
Trees in Alberta, how do they sell? Are people keen to get trees?
Oh, I sold them on a livestock auction.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they sold miscellaneous on Tuesday morning. They did hay. They did hay and straw on 10 o'clock, and they did trees at 11 o'clock. I started small, but after years, I sold a lot of plants.
What kind of trees were you selling?
All hardy stuff.
Just yeah, of
for
course.
Just for shelter bells, like blue spruce.
For sure.
And garganas, and then people say, well, there's billions of garganas. But they sold. And raspberries and rhubarb and just plain simple stuff that was hardy that would be life. Yeah.
Did you go to a particular point of choosing strains that would make it through the winter and the summer?
Oh, yeah. They have to be hardy enough. Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Now, the name of your operation was Blooming Fields, the Blooming Fields. That suggests that Marianne had a hand in deciding the name because you're the flower lady. What relevance did that name have to what you were doing?
I don't know. Like we.
I mean, did you have lots of flowers in the tea house?
Yeah. No. The idea was like a lush, blooming acreage that was inviting to people. That was kind of the main thought behind it.
And was that what people came for? The sort of this oasis in the middle of the desiccated prairie?
I think so. It was like a little oasis in the middle of farmland.
So how did you make it? Was the land an oasis when you started out?
No, it was.
Okay, so you made it an oasis.
It was completely bare.
Really?
No, it was completely covered in native
plants.
Oh,
native plants. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yes, grass.
With the yellow flowers.
You have the yellow flowers. And so what did you do to make it an oasis that was a draw for busloads of tourists?
Well, we planted shelter bed all the way around and trees for windbreaks and whatever.
So people could drive as they approached your destination resort. They could see this phalanx of trees out in the middle of the prairie.
Yeah, in the beginning you could see it. Now you can see nothing anymore. It's all overgrown now. So it's
really.
Yeah.
And so when you left, did you sell it to somebody who was interested in keeping it up, or just?
Yeah, a little bit.
A little bit.
But now it's a wedding venue, eh?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. What a transformation.
Yeah.
From a growing operation and a destination resort, the only people who come are people who want to get married. Are there remnants of the trees in the forest?
I think so.
Oh, that's interesting. However, your daughter wasn't there anymore. She'd actually moved here.
Yes.
Yeah.
At one point in the conversation we had the other day, you said, well, why did you move here? Well, our daughter was here. And I was beginning to think your daughter sort of controlled your life, but I realized you had other designs as well. So what was it about this part of the world that you, who've traveled in different places in Canada and around the world, were drawn to?
The lake.
The lake. A body of water that you can trust.
Yeah, but...
It won't be coming up this hillside.
We always... like to go to the beach in Holland as well, and the lake was a big draw, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
now skiing is a big draw as well.
That's water in frozen form.
Yeah.
What about you, Pim? What did you sense that was here that really mattered?
Well, it must be a good climate because you have wineries and all the fruit growing, and native people are here.
Yes.
And they know where to stay. Because in Alberta we had nothing.
Sure.
In all of...
You were the native people.
In that whole area, there were no native people.
Yeah. Nothing. Did you ever talk to them, or did you just sort of sense what if there's still indigenous people living here, they must know something about this place?
Yeah, but they know that from all the years that they are here.
10,000 years.
Yeah.
Got a good place to hang out.
There were rivers and there was fish and whatever.
So what in the way of... Once you decided to move, you, of course, needed to find a place to live and also work. I have a place that you could keep up. So what was it about this property that, when you heard it was available, made you think it would be right for you? Pim?
No, we liked the laying of the land. That was pretty important to me, but we liked the house, too.
What do you like about the house? It's a nice little house.
Yeah, it's a cozy house, and we thought, well, we have to fix up some things, but that's doable. We can do it ourselves, so let's buy it, and then we make a plan that we have to renovate the next years in the winter.
Yes.
So that's what we did. We're almost done now. So,
Marianne, when you saw this house, and you saw that, well, for both of you... You'd worked, Pim, in large landscaping jobs for people who had large houses. But in Holland, space is at a premium. What was it like to move into a nice, cozy house as opposed to a big place?
Well, the cozy part, I guess. and in Mission, we had a huge house with a 9-foot ceiling.
No, it was 27 feet high in the middle of the ceiling.
Oh, 9 meters, yeah.
9 meters. That's a very high ceiling.
Yeah,
it is.
It was hot in the house.
it was facing south with all those windows.
Yes, nobody thinks about climate control as part of the world. No.
But, you know, this felt like home. It had a big kitchen, which I like. And,
You have a big kitchen now.
Yes, I do.
Yeah. The centerpiece of the house.
Yeah. So no, it was, you know, you have to love a house in order to live in it.
Sure.
And I loved it.
Did you make it into a house that you loved? Did you change things around?
Oh, yeah. We did.
What was important to you to have in your home, to make it feel like a home?
Colors.
Colors.
Yeah, and
what are your favorite colors? You're the fine arts teacher.
Well,
what do you do at home?
I have bright colors. Lots of different colors.
Yes. What do they call it? Feature walls?
Yeah.
You have feature walls?
Yeah.
And you have wall hangings?
Yeah.
Do you do that quite a bit? Using your artistic talents to create things?
Yeah, the winter time is a good time for that.
Yes. And the summer, what about horticulture? What about flowers and doing things with flowers? Do things like that still?
Yeah, but not as much anymore as I did before. Like, I don't know, summertime we get usually quite a bit of company. And then with the business, there's not much time to do side stuff. And then when we have time, we like to go to the lake.
Well, you're not alone. Apparently the lake is well populated. Pim, how did you rework? You described a little bit how you reworked the land to make it suit your own goals. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about how that happened? What did you say? You saw this cherry orchard with grass underneath it, and you said, I can make something out of this, but it's not going to be just a cherry orchard.
Yeah, it's certified organic, so that means you have to stay 8 meters away from your neighbors. And our property is 50 meters wide, so 8 meters on both sides. That means a third is gone already.
Indeed.
So you have to be practical, so you can use it as a headland to turn around at 8 meters. And I planted shelter belts on both sides.
Right.
Because there's some trees from the neighbors, but yeah, the neighbors, they can move tomorrow. That's you have nothing to say. You never know.
That's right.
Over the years, so
you're able to plant the shelter belts within that 8 meter.
Yeah, yeah. Because it's not, you don't eat it or whatever.
No.
So that's allowed. So it's, and they promote that too, to get more bees and birds and whatever.
For sure.
So
for sure.
More trees and plants. And
you let it a bit go a bit wild.
Yeah.
In those 8 meters.
Yeah. First I kept it clean, but no, I'm changing all the time, so it's getting easier.
Yes. So for the rest of the property, what did you do?
What also appealed to me, there were some big trees on the property. I really liked that because we always started with bare land, but now we have some.
Are there big trees in Holland?
Not that much where we were, because that was flooded in 1953.
Okay.
So they all died.
Mm.
And in the war, they cut all the big trees down and they made all those, how did they call those, Rommelspergers.
Oh.
What they said for the landing.
Oh, yeah.
For the invasion.
Landing, the invasion.
So they cut everything down.
So the country had been left almost barren.
Yeah.
Wow.
Not in all of Holland, but the provinces where we were.
Yeah, for sure.
On the coast, yeah. So
you had a couple of, a few big trees on the property that you really liked and you left them.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They're grateful. On behalf of the trees, I'd like to say thank you.
I think they were planted almost at the same year, the way I look at it. I think they are from the first homeowners.
Really?
And they
like the first homesteaders that
came
out.
Yeah, they built the house, I think.
So they could be 100 years old, some of them.
No,
70, 80 years or something like that.
That's good.
It's
70, 80
it's
in
nice
human
to
terms.
Have them. I really enjoy that.
Yeah. And what else did you do? You converted it into a vegetable landscape.
Yeah, and then I put all the drip irrigation in. So that's easy. Otherwise, there's not much growing, I think.
And for sure.
It's way too dry, so that's all done.
And drip irrigation is really efficient.
Yeah.
Instead of just spraying the water in the air, with way a lot of people do.
Because then you get the weeds everywhere. Now you drip so it doesn't evaporate. It goes where the plant is.
Sure.
It goes down. So,
So you really set it up in a fairly comprehensive way. It was not just, planting vegetables. You actually designed it quite carefully, it sounds like.
Yeah, because when you grow veggies, you get the chance two or three times a year to do it in a better way.
Indeed.
But when you plant strawberries, raspberries, asparagus, all those things, that stays. So you really
perennials.
Have to think ahead and say, hey, how big will they get? Can I get in between? How about the weeds?
Are they going to take over the entire property one day?
Yeah,
yes,
so,
indeed.
Yeah.
Remind listeners again that I'm speaking today with Pim and Marianne van Oeveren, who are the owners and the busy workers on Tasty Acres, a property on North Broadview that grows a lot of vegetables. And I have 3 asparagus plants in my backyard that are from Tasty Acres, and they're looking very healthy, I'm happy to say. So you started to grow food, and then gradually there was a sort of a transition to a you-pick kind of approach. How did that happen? What made that happen?
Yeah, the goal was to grow food plant, so you can eat something from the plant, or the plant itself, or the seeds, or the roots, or the
and
the
you're growing it for yourselves as well to eat.
Yeah.
So you eat your own food out of the garden. Yes.
Yeah. And then we have a lot of strawberries, but yeah, they start to produce too. So then Marianne said, "Well, let's sell them." And from there it took
off.
Very
practical.
Yeah.
And you did.
Yeah, we did. And it went really easy. We are on the right spot, I think, in town.
Yes.
It's a big road and people can see us. And
indeed.
Yeah. So.
And, of course, listeners probably will remember that at one point this was called the Cherry Berry Bin, and it was when it was a cherry orchard.
Mm-hmm.
And the owner previous to you had converted to organic, and there is a lot more interest in organic growing. Was that organic aspect of it something important, say, for you, for your health, for your family, Marianne?
Yeah, because in Alberta we were transferring from conventional to organic already. We were not certified, but we...
You were on the way.
We were on the way. We were in Cuba 1 year with a tour, with an agricultural tour, and we saw how well organic did, and that changed our life quite dramatically. And then decided...
What was it about what you saw in Cuba that changed things? That
how well things would grow.
Yes.
And how prosperous things were, even though they didn't spray chemicals.
Yeah.
And how good it can grow without all this stuff.
Right.
They did it real simple.
Yeah.
Because after the Russians left, they didn't have any money, so they were
indeed
completely on their own.
Yes. No, I've been to Cuba a couple of times and looked at their organoponicas. And it is quite dramatic.
Yeah.
And it's also a sign of what happens when you have free education for your citizens.
Yeah.
Because
yes,
they had a lot of talent in Cuba, highly educated talent, to convert the country almost overnight. 1989 was the year that the Soviet Union collapsed.
Yeah.
And within 3 or 4 years... I visited Cuba, and organic was, they were the biggest organic growing country in the world at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Now, organic farmers still use some means of controlling, say, insect pests, plant pests. And your farm uses an interesting compound called spinosad. Tell me a little bit about how you got to use that, because it's here people use... BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, for vegetables, for, you know, caterpillars and that kind of thing on cabbages. But spinosad is not so widely used. So did you know about that from when you had been in Holland, or was it new?
No, it was on the farm. The previous owner was using it too, so that's how I got to know it. It's
and found that it worked okay.
Yeah, yeah.
The just for listeners who may not be familiar with this particular substance, it's an insecticide, and is based on chemical compounds found in a bacterial species called Saccharopolyspora spinosa, and it's an actinomycete, and actinomycetes are bacteria that actually have qualities related to funguses. They put out little hyphae, though, these little branching arms that go under the soil and go from one to another. And they do well in the root system of many plants and supply, so they supply fertilizer, but they also can supply this insecticide. And apparently, the spinosad, there's several varieties of it, were discovered in the mid-80s from sugarcane that was lying around, the sugarcane was lying around outside a run-down sugar mill that also made rum in the Virgin Islands in the Caribbean. And in addition to supplying an insecticide, it also supplies many antibiotics and many other medicines that we use. For example, actinomycetes produce compounds that are used in human medicine a great deal. And I'll just name some of them. Streptomycin, neomycin, which is used on the skin. Polysporin has neomycin in it. Kanamycin, clindamycin, gentamicin, and vancomycin, they all belong to a particular family of antibiotics. Another one called chloramphenicol, tetracycline, erythromycin, and then the cancer drugs, known as bleomycin, doxorubicin, and I've had patients who've received these drugs, and tacrolimus, which is also a drug used to treat cancer and various other conditions. And then a very important compound that makes penicillin able to survive in the human body when organisms are there that break penicillin down. It's called clavulinic acid, and it's used in combination with penicillin. When you put the two together, the penicillin survives and works just like it is supposed to. And then even an antifungal, a drug called nystatin that's extremely widely used to treat many fungal conditions. So this is a very prolific family of organisms, and drug companies use them a lot. How do you use it? Because it has insecticidal qualities and it's nonspecific, so you have to be careful to avoid beneficials, for example. So how do you make this work properly?
Well, to avoid spraying the bees, you can do it at in the evening or early in the morning, so they are not out.
Right.
But I think when they still touch it, they might be killed. Mm-hmm. But that's a drawback from it.
Right. But it also deals with a lot of pest insects.
Yeah.
What kind of things that did you find it worked best for? Or you just said, I'll spray and see them. See them in the morning.
it's a broad working thing, so it's easy to use for that, in that case. So.
The most of what keeps plants healthy, though, is giving them good food, having good soil.
Yeah.
So soil must have been something from the very beginning in your career. You focused your attention on creating healthy soil.
Yeah.
What do you use on Tasty Acres mostly to make it rich, healthy soil?
Well, we use a lot of compost. And also the last couple of years, more and more cover crops, clover and oats and rye and tillage, radish. You have to improve the soil. When it's not in the soil, it will be never in the stuff you sell.
Yes, so indeed.
It's so important. And another thing is for diseases, you have to keep the plant healthy, and you can measure that with the Brix meter.
Okay.
That's what they use in the wineries too. On the fruit to see if it's sweet enough to harvest it. It's really easy. You squash them and you put it in and you hold it against the sun and you can see.
Yes.
Make the reading, and that's, yeah.
And that tells you when to harvest.
Yeah. But also to see, you can see how healthy your crop is doing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like so it's
and
mature.
Then you can adjust and say, hey, I have to spray molasses or sugar or some minerals or whatever you think you need. But it's a real, it's a game. What do you need? What do you... you can go on the safe side and say use kelp. Kelp has almost everything. In the
Indeed.
Sea is everything you need. Otherwise, it wouldn't grow in the sea. So that's doable too. But yeah.
Now you're watching this man out in the yard working away. How do you join in, Marianne?
I'm the one for the native control of plants.
So what are the kind of tasks that you end up doing?
I do a lot of weeding.
Yes.
And
What kind of weeding? Like, do you have implements to make weeding easier?
Pim does it with the machinery, and I do it by hand.
So you go in among the plants.
Yeah. He does too, but usually we go early in the morning and weed for a couple of hours, and then we have coffee.
That's a very civilized way to do things.
Yeah.
The range of food you produce now is quite broad. Why don't you? What are your favorites, Marianne, that you really are happy to distribute to the world?
I love cherries. And
do you?
And when we bought the place, I was so happy because that's my favorite fruit. So yeah. Cherries are
they a challenge? I hear that sometimes if there's a bit of rain, then you get a lot
challenge. Of... Cherries are a challenge, that's for sure. Like if it rains during harvest, then they split. And worms are a challenge. You have to spray something in order to prevent them from getting worms. So it's easier to grow strawberries, I think.
Does the spinosad work for the worms that are in cherries?
For cherry fruit fly, yeah.
Yeah. Good, because one of your neighbors down the road on 30th invited us over to pick cherries from his untended crop, and we had beautiful looking cherries, took them home, and every single one had a worm there in the middle looking at us and saying, "Hi, nice to meet you."
Yeah.
You don't have that. No. Tell me you don't have that.
No, we don't.
Thank you.
Sometimes on the end of the season, then you think, well, now it's almost over, I can take my chance, and then...
But you don't.
No.
Normally we don't.
You assume that there could be a worm lurking around waiting to...
Yeah, but I usually don't look what I eat, so I keep eating them from the trees, and then somebody tells me, there's a lot of worms in it. Did you see it? No.
No.
You don't taste them.
No. They're good protein.
Yeah.
So what else do you sell into the community these days?
We also grow garlic and big onions like the Walla Wallas, the sweet ones.
Lovely onions.
Yeah, rhubarb, asparagus.
The fruit is all you pick, but the vegetables we pick ourselves, and then a lot of that goes to Askew's. Askew's gets all our garlic, they get... the onions, they get
rhubarb,
artichokes, Jerusalem artichokes.
Yes.
So that goes all to Askew's.
What do you feel is sort of the... Whenever somebody sets up a farm like this, they do it not just because they want a farm. They also want to say something to themselves and to the world about why they're doing it. Mm-hmm. Pim... What's the motivation, the value system that you think of when you're working on this farm of yours?
It's just fun to grow stuff. I like it. I like to work the soil and see how it's doing. And then I'm always amazed that We have a certain spot in the farm that's the best soil from the whole farm. And whatever you grow there, it's always the best crop you have. If it's carrots or garlic or whatever. I think there was an old compost pile around there somewhere. Mm. But that's, and then I imagine when the whole farm was that quality. Can we get there? Can we make it that good? And then, so with the whole trend in regenerative farming, the most important thing is people have to see it. Farmers have to see it before they believe it. That's the biggest task we have, I think, to show it to people and say, hey, it's doable.
Irma Bombeck is a writer of comedy books, and she's one of the titles was "The Grass Is Always Greener Over the Septic Tank."
Yeah.
So organic input to a soil is a very valuable thing. Marianne, what, apart from the fact that it was a nice flat driveway mm-hmm. and a cozy house, mm-hmm. what was it about this place that you're in now that expresses something about who you are as a person?
That's hard to answer. It's a place where we have lots of friends over and family. It's a place that feels like home. It's a place close to the lake.
You can't get away from water if you're born and raised in Holland.
I guess so.
It's in your blood.
Yeah, but it feels like a place where we can grow roots even if we're older.
Well, you have, speaking of that, just we have a couple more minutes, but you have traveled a lot around the world looking at places where lots of things happen that you're interested in. I had a list of the countries you'd been to, and it's pretty dramatic. If I can find it. Here we are. Cuba, you've mentioned already. India, Vietnam, Curacao, a little Dutch route there. Bonaire, which is France, Belgium, Portugal, U.S., England, Germany, and indeed we mentioned Holland, Canada. So when you travel, what are you looking for, Pim?
Well, first, what's growing there?
Yes.
and the trees and what's flowering and how will they do it? And it all amazes me how there are so many different systems of doing things. And you see the same plants all over the world, but But like rice, they grow them in water and they grow them dry. And there's so many things you can do. It's
Mother Nature's very...
Yeah.
Has lots of faces.
Yeah.
Marianne, what do you like to see when you travel?
I like to see things like culture, things, and how people sell stuff. Like, it's totally different if you go in India to a market than when you are in Holland in a market.
Slightly chaotic.
Yeah, but also colorful. And there's an abundance. I'm like Pim. We like to visit botanical gardens, and in England we visit a lot of the National Trust gardens, and that kind of stuff.
And you've also done some service work. The last trip you took this winter was to California, and you worked on a Mennonite rebuilding project, which has also been part of what you do.
Yeah.
So I think it's fair to say that there's a kind of a service culture built into what you do, and serving the planet, obviously, by what you grow, by having organic certification. You are really, I think, a model for a lot of people. And you're doing it not in your spring years of, your 20s, but you're doing it in your later years. And I guess it shows everybody that life continues into your older years, doing good things for the world. We're very grateful for you both to be on the show with us today. Thank you very much for coming in.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.